How many times have you heard it said, you are what you eat?
Many.
Right. In fact, it's been said so often it sounds trite. It's almost a cliche. But you know, nothing could be more true. The foods we eat are the bricks and the mortar that we use to build and to rebuild our bodies every day. So what we eat matters.
Indeed, it does.
Our bodies are wonderfully adaptable. We're able to make do with whatever raw materials we have available to us, and that feature by itself has contributed to our survival over the millennia. But now we live in a time of plenty, and consequently, we should be less concerned with making do than with reclaiming and optimizing our health and reaching our full potential. And the foods we eat really are the key to doing that.
That's absolutely right. Everything we eat, every mouthful of food has an inescapable biochemical consequence. And depending upon what we eat, it could be a good one that's going to lead towards balance and health.
Or, you know, it could be a disastrous one, too.
A very disastrous one, but one thing truly is certain. There's going to be a consequence of some sort. And by understanding just a little bit about the biochemistry of food, we can not only predict what that consequence is going to be, we can actually select the metabolic effect we want, which is very important. And as I said before, it's nothing more than applied biochemistry.
You know, when I was a kid, I had a chemistry set. Maybe you did too. You know the kind I mean, the one that comes with all the little vials of colorful chemical crystals and a few test tubes and a book of instructions.
I remember.
Oh, yes, I had one. And if you followed those instructions, and if you mixed the right amounts of the chemicals from the various little bottles as they directed you to do, the experiment would work. And if you didn't, you usually made a huge mess, and I made a few of those.
As did I.
Well, that's a pretty good analogy for human nutritional biochemistry. The colorful chemicals are like the foods that you eat, and you're putting them into a test tube that we call your body. And if you do it right, the experiment works, and health and fitness result.
And if you do it wrong, you have the kind of result that I often had with my chemistry set, and you have a mess.
Now, let's look at food for what it really is. It's a source of raw materials that we use to replace the wear and tear of living. It's also a powerful chemical fuel that we can use to restore harmony to our metabolism.
And food is basically four things. It's water, it's fat, it's protein, and it's carbohydrate, the macronutrients we talked about before. And we can describe every food we eat, and it doesn't matter if it's bacon or brownies or cabbage, it doesn't matter what it is, we can describe it as being made of varying amounts of these four basic components because that's all that there is.
Take a steak. That's protein, fat, and water.
How about a cookie?
Carbohydrate, fat, and water.
How about yogurt?
Well, that's all four of them.
Sugar?
All carb.
Butter?
Practically all fat.
So, we have four basic food components, and what you need to know is how does each one of those influence the two critical metabolic hormones that we've been talking about, insulin and its balancing partner, glucagon.
Your goal in rehabilitating your health and fitness hinges on bringing insulin levels down and letting glucagon levels rise and restoring the close balance between these two opposing forces. So let's look at each of the foodstuffs, protein, fat, carbohydrate, and water, and see why they're important to us and what they do to insulin and glucagon.
All right. Well, let's start with water. It is, of course, a substance crucial to life. And, you know, we lose it in sweat and in urine and in tears and in our breath and in the vapor in our breath and in our stools. And we use it in billions of chemical reactions taking place all day long. And we've got to replace the loss.
We especially need water when we turn to the oxidation or the burning of stored body fat as our main metabolic energy source.
It's true because when we reduce calories, particularly if we're exercising, our need or our requirement for water-based fluid goes up by as much as 50% over our usual need. So for that reason alone, we recommend that you drink a minimum of 64 ounces of non-caloric water-based fluids every day to meet these needs.
Let's talk for just a second about these 8 glasses of water. When we say 64 ounces of water, it doesn't have to be plain water. It could be decaffeinated or regular coffee, regular or herbal tea. You know, there's no doubt that pure fresh water is probably the best source for replacing your fluid loss, but it doesn't have to be just water. Good quality mineral waters are fine, but at home we often make our own mineral water by simply filtering our city tap water and adding back in the trace minerals that our municipal water treatment department takes out.
If you choose to use caffeine or some of the artificial sweeteners, you've got to be aware that for some people these can be troublesome. Some people release a little insulin in response to the glandular stimulation of caffeine. And this effect can slow the progress of these people by keeping them hungry or by dropping their blood sugar a little bit.
You know, artificial sweeteners do the same thing. They can cause a little bit of insulin release when they stimulate the sweet taste buds. You know, your tongue has taste buds for sweet, for sour, for salty, and bitter. And the sweet receptors, when they're stimulated, can cause you to release a little bit of insulin. The tongue tastes the sweet, and your body thinks that it's sugar coming in. But then nothing happens because there is no sugar coming in. And once the insulin has been released out into your blood, you can't call it back. So it causes a little drop in blood sugar just from drinking those artificially sweet things. And that can make you hungry.
Yeah, because as we'll see a little bit later, falling blood sugar is one of the most potent hunger-stimulating forces that we have.
And in addition, we've found out some information that we think is compelling enough to really make us want to eliminate aspartame from our diets. I don't recommend it to our patients anymore, and I don't use it myself. The problem mainly concerns the brain cells. There's some evidence to suggest that maybe aspartame leads to brain cell death, and when it does, it can cause problems like depression or memory loss, fuzzy thinking, or sleep disturbances.
And since the jury is really still out on it, we recommend that our patients not use it, and we don't use it ourselves.
You know, until the FDA approves the new product, sucralose...
It's a Canadian product.
Right, it's in all the soft drinks in Canada. Until they approve it for use here, we're pretty much hanging with the recommendation that if you're going to use an artificial sweetener, use saccharin. Or stevia, which is a natural herbal product that you can get at a health food store if you want to sweeten something. But really, the best thing is just to allow the natural sweetness that's in food to be the sweet that you taste.
And you'll discover that as you eliminate more and more sweets from your diet, that your sweet receptors, just like your insulin receptors, they'll rehabilitate a little bit, and it won't take nearly the amount of sweet to stimulate them. So foods that before you may not have thought of as being particularly sweet...
Like a green bean,
exactly, will taste a lot sweeter to you once this kind of bluntness or dullness is taken away from your sweet receptors.
Well, what about fat? That's the dietary villain, right?
So we hear.
Well, you hear it all the time. You eat fat, you get fat. Or this variant, just keep your fat grams under 30 or 20 or 10... and all your health problems will vanish.
Yeah, we've only heard that about 200,000 or 300,000 times.
It's goodbye to body fat, cholesterol problems, blood pressure problems, heart disease, diabetes, all the problems of modern life. And it sounds so simple, but is it?
I don't think so.
No. America has cut its fat consumption over the last 30 years. We have reduced our intake of fat from about 40% of calories to about 34% of calories.
And that's about a 25 to 30% reduction in fat calories.
And so during this same 30-year period, has obesity declined?
Not at all.
No, more Americans are fatter than ever. Simply removing fat calories from the American diet and replacing them with some other calories has really been of no use in solving the health problems that bedevil Americans. In fact, it's even proven counterproductive.
That's exactly right. And why? You only have to refer to any standard textbook of medical biochemistry for the answer. Of the two hormones that profoundly influence the development of these disorders...
Those being insulin and glucagon.
Exactly. Insulin and glucagon, the two hormones we've been talking about, fat exerts the same effect as water.
None. Zippo. Nothing.
Zero. Zip. A big goose egg as far as insulin and glucagon are concerned. Fat is a stealth nutrient.
It is not the culprit in the fattening of America.
That's exactly right. But beyond that, we've got to remember that we need some fat for good health. I mean, we humans have a number of fat-dependent organ systems. Our hair, our skin, our nails, our eicosanoid messenger system, all the major adrenal hormones, estrogen, testosterone, cortisol, aldosterone, all require adequate amounts of dietary fat for optimal function.
And what's more important to us as doctors treating insulin disorders is really not so much the quantity of fat that you consume, it's the quality.
That's right. We encourage you to eat fats, but fats as nature intended them. Unaltered by a manufacturer. You know, if manufacturers fiddle with the chemistry of a fat to turn it into something it's not, it's suspect at best. The buzzword that we use is that you should eat unaltered fats and oils. In terms of solid or saturated fats, that means butter, not margarine. In liquid fats, it means that we want you to eat oils that come from oily sources. Olives, nuts, seeds, avocados. And we want them naturally pressed so that we're sure that their quality is good and that they're pure. A good rule of thumb is to eat only oils that come from substances that you can get the oil out of just by squeezing. Those are the things that I've just mentioned, the nuts and the seeds and those kind of things. When you talk about corn oil, I mean, you can squeeze corn until the cows come home, and all you're going to get out of it is corn juice. Corn oil has got to be chemically extracted, and when you chemically extract it, you alter the quality of the oil. So that's why we don't like to use corn oil. And so instead, stick to these kind of oily sources for more natural substances.
Natural fats. I know a lot of you may be aware of the mounting evidence against certain substances that are called trans fats as being health hazards, but some of you may not be so aware, so let me quickly review what that means. Polyunsaturated oils, those that come from squeezing corn or other vegetables, are chemically extracted oils that are very, very unstable by their very natures. To keep those oils from going rancid on the shelf,
where they often sit for 6 months or more before the unwary customer takes them home,
well, they have to undergo a process that is termed partial hydrogenation. In short, that means that they have to be artificially partly saturated to improve their shelf life. In this process, the oil is heated up to a really high temperature and put under pressure. And then using a chemical catalyst, hydrogen atoms are forced into the structure of the oil molecule. And when this occurs naturally, all of the hydrogens sort of line up on the same side of the carbon bonds. That's called a cis configuration. In the artificial process, however, they line up across the bonds from one another, the trans configuration, because they pack better, they store better, but they're not good. You know, that seems like such a small thing, but the exact configuration of a molecule is of paramount importance to the enzymes in your body that tear that molecule apart to use it. And so they're important for its action. With a trans fat, the structure of the molecule changes. When the structure changes, it interferes with the production of microhormone messengers that we call eicosanoids. They make substandard raw materials for the body to use, and all the fat-dependent organ systems and fat-dependent hormones to be made from.
And so we counsel our own patients to eat good fats, keep the quantity reasonable and the quality excellent, and not really worry about counting fat grams because our bodies have built-in fat monitors to let us know that we've eaten enough.
You know, I'm sure some of you out there are saying, yeah, but what about the calories? Everybody knows that fats are a rich source of calories, so how can we eat fat and lose weight? A calorie is a calorie, right?
Well, let's see. There's a classic study published in the prestigious British medical journal, The Lancet, detailing the results of an inpatient study performed at Middlesex Hospital in London by the research team of Keckwick and Pawan. And their purpose in this study was to determine what, if any, raw composition of diet had on weight loss. And here's what they did. They took a group of overweight people and placed them on a diet.
They gave them all 1,000 calories a day. Everybody got the same thing. But they gave it in three different ways. One group had their 1,000 calories as 90% protein. The 10% remaining was fat and carbohydrate. One group had 90% carbohydrate. And one group had 90% fat. If a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, as we've all heard, then you would think that the weight loss should have been the same for all three dietary compositions, right? Same number of calories, same expected weight loss. But was it?
No, not at all. Those eating the diet that was 90% carbohydrate had the least weight loss of all.
Some subjects actually gained on 1,000 calories if it was mainly given as carbohydrate,
which we see every day in our practice. The 90% protein diet on this study caused substantial weight loss, but, and here's the surprising thing, the biggest weight loss of all occurred on the 90% fat diet. Now, how can that be?
Well, I guess you could say, well, maybe they failed to absorb the calories if it was given as fat or protein.
But the researchers looked at that and the conclusion was no.
You know, the high-carb, low-fat gurus would explain the results away, saying, it's just water loss.
Yes, but the good doctors studied that also, and the results showed that body water remained surprisingly constant, so it wasn't the water loss. What was it?
Well, let's look at what the authors themselves said. Let me read to you what they said. There seems to be only one reasonable explanation, namely, that the composition of diet can alter the expenditure of calories in obese persons. What does that mean?
That simply means that depending on the caloric content, depending on the types of food, the fat, protein, and carbohydrate, makes a difference in how well people either store or burn those calories. And based on the results of this study, it clearly shows that people with the higher carbohydrate diets tend to store the calories better, whereas the people with the higher protein and the higher fat diets tended to burn the calories better because the high carbohydrate diet subjects actually gained weight or didn't lose weight very well at all, whereas the other people lost it much, much more efficiently, and all on the same number of calories.
And so what that really means to the dieter is that it matters what your calories are. A calorie isn't just a calorie, and you can eat more calories if they're the right calories.
That's exactly right.
Well, if neither fat or water influences insulin or glucagon, what about protein? How does it influence this system? Protein will restore the balance of a confused metabolic system. In overweight people, composition of diet makes a big difference.
Correct. And a lot more recent studies have borne out this fact, that as people become obese, it takes less energy for them to burn carbohydrate, whereas the amount of energy required to use protein stays the same.
And that means that in overweight people, the caloric cost of digesting carbohydrate and fat goes down. It takes fewer calories to do that work. But the cost for protein remains high, so it should make more sense to encourage people to eat greater proportions of these costly calories.
Which is exactly what we do, and indeed it does work.
And that's good too, because protein is absolutely and incontrovertibly essential to human life.
Absolutely true, and that's a very important point. We've got to have protein, and the only place we can get it is from our diet. We need it to maintain the wear and the tear on our lean body tissues that just comes from the everyday act of living. And of course, the harder we use the lean body that we have, the more wear and tear it gets, and the more protein per pound that it's going to take to maintain it. Now, every day, the average adult needs to eat somewhere between a half a gram and a gram of complete protein for each pound of lean body mass.
The lower end of that scale applies to the couch potatoes and the channel surfers, and the high end to the elite athletes in training. The big middle of it, that's the vast majority of the rest of us.
Right. And so what does that mean? Does that mean that you have to eat mountains of meat?
Well, it could, but it doesn't have to. Lean protein can be found in a wide variety of places in addition to lean red meat. You could eat fish,
seafood,
poultry,
dairy products,
egg protein. In fact, this dietary structure works very well even for vegetarians, using tofu, tempeh, texturized vegetable protein, or spirulina. It's going to take a fair amount of these things to get the job done, but it works just fine.
Yeah, and I would say that, what, 10% of our patients are vegetarians?
Yeah, I would bet about 10% who are strict vegetarians, but we've got a lot of people who will use eggs or milk or other dairy products, but of strict vegetarians, maybe about 10%, and they do beautifully on this kind of a structure.
Absolutely.
Now, we recommend that you spread your protein out throughout the day in a minimum of about 4 meals. It could be 3 meals and a snack, or 2 pretty good-sized meals and a couple of smaller ones, because it has an effect on the hormones whether you eat it all at once or you spread it out, and it works much, much better if you spread it out. And we finally have here a macronutrient that does something, and it has a glorious effect. When you eat protein and you get a rise in insulin, you match that rise by a rise in glucagon. Imagine that, those two hormones rising and falling in harmony, just the way nature intended.
That's right, and that's why protein is the cornerstone of our nutritional regimen, and why it should be the cornerstone of yours. Now, we're going to talk a lot on a later tape about how much protein you're going to get and how to calculate it and all of that. But for right now, the important thing to remember, the take-home message, is that protein is the essential nutrient, the crucial nutrient, the cornerstone of your entire diet.
And that will bring us to the last player in our macronutrient field, carbohydrate. You know, whether it's the middle of a baked potato, a whole wheat bagel, an ear of corn, or sugar that you spoon out of the bowl, all carbohydrates must be broken down into simple sugars for absorption.
That's the only way that they can get from your GI tract into your blood.
Starting with saliva, and in the stomach and the digestive juices, we have to cleave wheat starch that's in pasta or bread into individual molecules of glucose before it can enter the body. Just as we have to cleave table sugar into a molecule of glucose and a molecule of fructose. And although starches take a little bit longer, in metabolic terms, it's really not much longer. For example, take a cracker, a little tiny square of wheat starch, and take a bite out of that, and hold that bite in your mouth for just a few minutes. Let your saliva begin to work on it. What do you think happens?
It begins to taste sweet.
Right. And that's because the enzymes in your saliva begin to tear apart that starch and turn it into glucose, and you taste it as sweet. And that means that for the purposes of this discussion, the metabolic effect of any carbohydrate on insulin and glucagon is the same.
And that's very important because every food that contains carbohydrate has a sugar equivalent. If you've got 50 grams of whatever kind of carbohydrate in a potato or wheat or whatever, That's going to convert to 50 grams of sugar. And so in the typical American diet, where a person gets, say, 400 grams of carbohydrate a day, that converts to 400 grams of sugar if your digestive tract is working properly. And 400 grams of sugar is 2 cups. So in the standard American diet, you're going to get 2 cups of sugar a day. And that goes from your digestive tract directly into your blood.
And into your fat cells.
And into your fat cells. And what's this going to do to your insulin?
Well, whether it's starch or sugar, they both cause a prompt increase in blood sugar that causes an equally prompt increase in insulin.
That's right. And so if the excess insulin and insulin resistance are indeed at the root of these so-called disorders of civilization that we've been talking about.
And there's really very little controversy that that indeed is the case?
Almost no controversy. Then will someone please explain to me why nutritional experts would think that they can solve the problem of too much insulin by encouraging a diet composed chiefly of carbohydrate? It doesn't make sense.
I mean, how could a diet structure recommending 6 to 11 servings of bread, cereal, and pasta every day possibly do anything except worsen an insulin problem?
It doesn't do anything. It does worsen an insulin problem, and that's why we're all becoming obese. That's why type 2 diabetes is going up. That's why deaths from heart disease are on the rise again. It's all really very simple.
You know, it's like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it and then standing back and scratching your head and wondering why it's blazing.
That's right, and yet that's precisely what the U.S. government food pyramid and countless nutritionists, dietitians, and even physicians recommend daily to their patients to combat these very same problems.
While some nutritional experts may not be getting the picture yet, you know, farmers have understood it for 100 years or more. You just ask a farmer, how do you fatten a hog? And he'll tell you straight up, you feed it corn.
Well, let's take it another step further. How do you fatten a human?
Well, you feed it 6 to 11 servings of bread, pasta, and cereal and low-fat grain every day. We've spent a lot of time talking about the macronutrients, protein, carbohydrate, and fat, and although they're the big picture, they're the part that we draw our calories from, they couldn't do their job without the help of what we think of as micronutrients. The micronutrients are vitamins and minerals. And you know, nutrition, or really the lack of nutrition, has shaped the world in which we live. From the very earliest medical writings, we can draw information about the influences of nutrition on our civilization. The diseases throughout human existence have given us a wealth of clinical data that we can use, and if we use it properly, we can benefit greatly from it.
You know, most vitamins were discovered by researchers based on their absence. In other words, when people didn't get enough of a certain vitamin or a mineral, that lack was manifest in a particular disease. And when scientists started looking around for the cause of that disease, they discovered it was because of one of these vitamin deficiencies. A classic case is beriberi, which was actually described by the Chinese back in 2500 BC. And that's caused by a thiamine deficiency. And the symptoms of beriberi are pain, weakness, sometimes paralysis, often muscle wasting. People have nausea, they vomit, they can get constipated. They sort of have this variety of gastrointestinal symptoms. And they become very irritable, they get depressed, and they can have all sorts of what we consider mental symptoms, you know, paranoia or dementia. And often it ends up with death if they're not replenished with the thiamine they need. And what does it come from? It comes because they ate polished rice, which milled away the husk or the bran of the rice, which removed the thiamine. Pellagra is another one.
You know, pellagra was first described in Spain in the 18th century. It was seen in groups of people that relied on corn or maize as a staple in their diet. And it was rampant in the United States after the Civil War because so many people were eating substances with such poor nutritional value. They were subsisting on white potatoes and sweet potatoes and corn, milled corn.
Another deficiency, and that's really kind of altered the course of human history, is scurvy, which, as we all know now, is a deficiency of vitamin C. And that was described in medical writings as early as 1500 BC, and it absolutely laid waste to the navies of many, many countries until 1753, when the British naval physician James Lind instituted the policy of fresh limes and lemons on voyages. And because the limes and lemons gave the sailors vitamin C, they didn't develop scurvy.
You know, that's the reason that the British Navy, the sailors in the British Navy, were called limeys, because they ate limes and lemons. And it's also probably the reason that the British Navy became so preeminent. Why, they basically conquered the seas. They could stay out on long voyages with their limes and their lemons, while the navies of other countries developed horrible problems with scurvy. Those problems are really terrible.
Yeah, the main problems of scurvy are fatigue and irritability and bleeding and inflammation of the gums. People will actually have their teeth fall out from scurvy. Even brushing their teeth a little bit could cause their teeth to fall out. They would have terrible bruising and have bad hemorrhages, and they could actually bleed to death internally. So it's a terrible, terrible disease that can totally be prevented with the consumption of vitamin C.
And rickets is another vitamin deficiency that, you know, we really don't see too much anymore. And in part, that's because milk products, dairy products in this country, are fortified with vitamin D, which is the vitamin that prevents rickets. We've known about rickets for many, many years. In fact, if you go back and you look at the bones of our ancient ancestors all through human development, there are sometimes signs of rickets. It was really first described as recently as the 17th century, which doesn't seem too recent to us, but looked against a backdrop of 1.5 million or more years of human development is really fairly a recent thing.
But, you know, we've talked about what vitamin deficiencies really are, but what are the vitamins themselves?
Well, vitamins are really nothing more than organic compounds. It just means that they are molecules made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And, in this case, a little sulfur or nitrogen or phosphorus, and occasionally another element or two thrown in. To be a true vitamin, to be considered a vitamin, whatever that substance is, must be essential for human health. That means it must be something that we can't make ourselves, and if it's absent from our diet, it has to cause an identifiable disorder, one that we can reproduce every single time that it's absent. Certainly, all these classic deficiency diseases fall into this category, because vitamins are really the facilitators of chemical reactions. They act as cofactors to make the billions and billions of chemical reactions that make us alive and keep us running smoothly work efficiently.
How much do we have to take? I mean, what kinds of vitamins do we have to take? Are there certain amounts that we have to take?
Well, the amount that we have to take depends on the vitamin, of course. But that's been looked at by careful studies and the determination of what's called the RDA, the recommended daily allowance of that vitamin. That's an amount that will ensure that you don't develop any of those specific deficiency diseases. And that's the point. Deficiency disease is what I said. That's a far cry from optimal health. How much does it take to optimize your health? That could be very different. You know, the RDA for a vitamin like vitamin E might be only 10 milligrams a day. But there have been a number of research studies that show that this particular antioxidant can protect against heart disease only if it's taken in 6 or 10 or even 40 times the amount recommended in the RDA.
That's right. Those are the famous cardiology studies where the cardiologists have discovered that it takes about 400 units of vitamin E to protect against coronary artery disease. And when asked, these cardiologists almost uniformly admit to taking it themselves, and yet only about 20% of cardiologists recommend vitamin E to their patients.
And if they did, they'd probably recommend the RDA, which is about 10 units. And that's
not enough to exert that protective effect.
No, that wouldn't help much at all. You know, the RDA for vitamin C, another really critically important nutrient, the one that causes scurvy if you don't have it, is only about 60 milligrams a day. There's been a lot of talk lately about raising that a little bit. The powers that be were going to raise the requirement for vitamin C, but I doubt they're going to raise it much. The work done by Linus Pauling over the last 30 or more years of his life points to an intake more on the order of 4,000 or even 20,000 milligrams a day as optimal. And I don't see a slight raise in the RDA is going to make much difference.
Based on our work with thousands of patients over the last 10 years or so, we've come up with a basic vitamin and mineral regimen that provides adequate amounts of all vitamins, minerals, and trace minerals important to reclaiming your health. And so let's kind of run through this list that we like to have our own patients take and talk about some of the individual vitamins, and then you'll be able to formulate your own vitamin program based on that and depending upon your own particular health problems. So let's take a look at the first vitamin group, the B vitamins.
You know, the B vitamins are really a large group of vitamins, and we think of them as numbers, B1, B2, B3, B12, B6. But they also have names, thiamin, niacin, riboflavin, and they work as a group. They function as a unit. And so when you take B vitamins, you want to take the whole family. You want to take the B complex because they work together. Their main job is in helping us to use the protein that we eat to repair our lean bodies. And so it's a crucial job. If you don't have enough of it, you can't make use of the macronutrient that you're eating.
And the Protein Power Plan itself is rich in B vitamins from animal protein, eggs, milk, nuts, seeds, and avocados. And the leafy green vegetables that are part of the program will provide plenty of folic acid, which is needed to absorb these B vitamins.
And so really, if you're eating the kind of diet we describe on the Protein Power Plan, You may not need to supplement with a lot, but if you do, you need to be sure that you get all the B vitamins, all the numbers together, because they work as a unit.
Well, what about the antioxidants? We've heard lots and lots about antioxidants. What do they do?
Well, the antioxidants are a curious group because they mainly serve to protect us from damage from free radicals. Now, a lot of you may not really understand what free radicals are, so let's look for a minute at that. You know, all of life is atoms in motion, swirling energy like the poles of a battery. We have a positive core that's surrounded by spinning negative electrons making up every single atom that makes us up, all the billions and billions of them. When one of those atoms loses one of its little negative electrons, it becomes unbalanced. It becomes a radical. It's a thing in search of an electron to restore its balance. Generation of those free radicals sets in motion a chain of events that could either be beneficial to us or could be detrimental. Free radicals damage our own tissues. They cause us to age.
Free radicals come from a variety of places. The air that we breathe, the oxygen that we breathe is a reactive substance, and it will cause some free radicals. We can't do without oxygen, so we're going to end up generating some free radicals. Now, we have the ability of our own bodies to protect ourselves to some degree by making what are called free radical scavengers. And a lot of what vitamins and minerals, for that matter, do is that they facilitate our ability to make those free radical scavengers. And we can get free radicals from riding in an airplane, from getting x-rayed, from smoking, from breathing in smog, from eating the wrong kinds of food. All kinds of things set this process in motion that ends up generating free radicals. And so the antioxidants prevent that from happening because they provide that electron to the free radical that it needs so desperately so that it doesn't take it from one of our own cells and damage it. Is that right?
Well, in a sense, yes. They don't exactly prevent it from happening, but they control it. And you know, you don't want to prevent it from happening entirely, because the other place that free radicals happen is when we try to attack invading bacteria or viruses or rogue cancer cells. We use free radicals to kill those things too, and so if we squelch out all of our free radicals by taking too many antioxidants, we can end up defenseless.
So then the free radicals are kind of like insulin and the Goldilocks and the three bears. We don't want too much and we don't want too little. We want just the right amount. And we can provide this right amount generally with the amount of antioxidants and vitamins and minerals that we get as part of the protein power plan. But as long as we supplement that with a good basic vitamin mineral complex, we're probably okay, and that is probably not going to do us any harm.
Yeah, not only is it not going to do us any harm, it'll probably do us a lot of good. Because as most of you know, knowing the right things to eat doesn't always translate into eating them. You know, you remember George Bush and his aversion to broccoli. Well, all of us have some of those dietary aversions that, although the things may be very good for us, we may not eat enough of them to matter.
So basically, a good vitamin mineral complex is nothing more than very inexpensive insurance.
Exactly. You don't want to oversupplement one antioxidant. For example, you wouldn't want to go out and just take huge quantities of vitamin E or beta carotene, for example. In fact, there was a study done recently that was looking at taking beta carotene as a means of preventing lung cancer. The study, of course, was done in smokers who have lots and lots of free radicals, and the study had to be aborted. The reason it did was because the smokers developed more lung cancer if they were taking beta-carotene. How could that be?
They were taking a substance that you would think would suppress the formation of their cancers, but what it was probably doing instead was suppressing so many free radicals that their own immune systems were impaired and let the cancers really develop at a much greater rate, so they had to stop the study prematurely.
And that, again, is why we recommend a balanced intake of complete vitamins and minerals, not just selecting one that you've heard good things about.
All right, let's turn our attention to the minerals for just a minute. Minerals are substances also that we get in the diet, and the diet that we eat has an influence on the minerals that are in our system. So let's look at a few of those. Let's look first at magnesium, probably far and away the most important mineral in all of human biochemistry. It's involved in over 320 enzymatic reactions that go on in the body all the time. And the amazing thing is that 74% of the population fails to get even the RDA of this mineral. And remember, that's a minuscule level, the RDA. And 74% of the population fails to even get that amount, which is a woefully inadequate amount in the first place. Now, our food supply is robbed of magnesium in a couple of different ways. The manufacturing and processing takes it out just like it puts sodium in. And processed foods that are high in sodium are also low in magnesium. The soils in which our food crops are grown have been long, long ago depleted in many cases of vital nutrients. And for the most part, these nutrients haven't been replaced because we don't replace magnesium into the soil. So even the whole foods that we eat and the nuts and the leafy green vegetables that should be good sources may also be deficient.
And you know, hard water from natural springs used to be one of the most important ways that we got magnesium. Certainly it was so for early man, but now our water supply is even deficient in magnesium. Water treatments used to soften water, to make it suds better so we can wash our clothes and our hair better, robs it of magnesium.
That's what the water softening process does. It removes the magnesium because magnesium binds with the soap and keeps it from sudsing. So when you have softened water, that's another way of saying you have magnesium depleted water.
You know, that's an easy way that you can check your own water at home and make a quick determination about whether it's full of minerals or whether it isn't. If the water sudses easily, it's been softened, and you probably need to remineralize that water. Whereas if it's difficult to work up a lather, that water may be pretty good water to drink.
And now bottled water, which many, many people are turning to now because they fear pollutants in the regular water supply, has also usually been depleted of magnesium because magnesium has a little bit of a funny taste. And actually, when you drink hard water, the taste that most people don't like is the magnesium in the water. Now, another thing that causes us problems with magnesium is that this whole insulin resistance syndrome, this hyperinsulinemia, comes about because insulin causes the body to lose magnesium. And when you start looking at people that have hyperinsulinemia, you find that virtually 100% of these people are magnesium deficient. People with high blood pressure are magnesium deficient. People with diabetes are all magnesium deficient. People that have elevated cholesterol are usually magnesium deficient. People who are obese are magnesium deficient. So magnesium deficiency goes kind of hand in glove with a hyperinsulinemia syndrome.
And you know, you don't even have to be overweight or metabolically out of shape to be deficient in magnesium, because sports, athletic endeavors can cause you to lose magnesium. And so if you're in pretty good shape and you're an avid runner or biker, you may be magnesium deficient too.
So how much magnesium do we need to take? I'd say at least 300 to 600 milligrams of a high quality chelate such as the citrate, the malate, or the aspartate. We need to take that much daily.
Let's take a look at the term chelate and talk about what that means.
Yeah, a chelate is a kind of a bond. Now, minerals come in two ways. They come in just their natural, organic way, and they can come in a chelated form. Now, I'm talking about not how they're found naturally, but how you find them in a health food store. And unfortunately, just elemental magnesium doesn't absorb very well. You may only get 10 or 20% absorption of elemental magnesium. But by chelating it, and that means by connecting the magnesium to another one of these chemicals, to citrate or malate or aspartate, that allows it to be digested much more easily with almost complete absorption. So you want to make sure that you have a chelated magnesium. And for that matter, chelated minerals in general when you buy them.
You know, the word chelate itself comes from a Greek word. It comes from a word meaning claw. And that's exactly what happens when they chelate these ions. When you take an ion and you build a kind of a protein or an amino acid cage around it, you take that into the body, and the stomach lining, for example, or the intestinal lining looks at that and it says, hey, there's a protein. And so you absorb it in much the same way you would a protein, completely, much more than if it were the simple ion that it started out. But magnesium is just one of the crucial minerals we need. It works in partnership with another, much more famous, I guess, mineral, and that's calcium. And while calcium is known to be important for strong bones, it really can't do anything without magnesium, boron, strontium, and a host of other bit players. But everybody's familiar with the notion that they need to take extra calcium, and women all over the country are chewing Tums by the dozens in order to get calcium.
And so when they take this calcium, though, it isn't really doing them a lot of good unless they get the magnesium and all these other things that go along with it.
Right. And you know, on the Protein Power Plan, the foods that we encourage you to eat, the dairy products and the other foods that are rich in calcium, should provide plenty of calcium to meet your needs. But if you don't eat those kind of foods, especially if you're a woman, you need to supplement with a little calcium, about equal to, but certainly no more than twice as much as the magnesium you're taking. So in that regard, you're looking at a calcium intake that's maybe 600 milligrams or maybe as much as 1,200 milligrams at the very most per day. And you know, with the insulin-resistant population, with those folks that are overweight, have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetic problems, there's a mineral that's even more important, and that's chromium. And chromium has gotten a lot of play lately. Everybody was looking at it as the new magic bullet. It was going to be what made everybody lean and thin. Why would that kind of thing have ever been said about a mineral like chromium?
Because chromium is a crucial component of the insulin receptor. And without chromium, the insulin receptors don't work well. Now, there's a deficiency in America that's estimated at 90%. American diets are deficient in chromium, and 90% of people don't get enough.
And that's, again, probably because it's depleted by diets that are high in carbohydrate and high in sugar, which pretty much describes the average American diet.
That's right, and it's also depleted with strenuous exercise, so chromium's important for the athlete. And because of its effect on the insulin receptor, a lot of people think it seems to contribute to these food craving problems that people have. So we recommend that our patients take at least 200 micrograms a day. Again, it's the chelate, in this case, usually picolinate.
But, you know, as much play in the press as chromium picolinate has gotten, it's not the only adequate chromium chelate. And, in fact, there are many others. You can look for almost anything that says 8 on the end of it, whether it's picolinate or gluconate or aspartate. All of those are chelates. And you can find a variety of them. Picolinate's the one out there in most health food stores anymore.
Yes, and the chromium is helpful, but it's mainly helpful if you have a deficiency. And once the deficiency is corrected, then taking all the chromium in the world isn't going to help you. So we don't like to load people up with chromium because generally 200 micrograms a day is a more than adequate amount to undo any depletion that people may have.
That's right. You know, it's hard to get chromium dietarily, again, because the soils are very poor in it. And one of the best sources is brewer's yeast, and a lot of folks can't tolerate yeast, so they're not using that. Another good source is black pepper, but there's so little in black pepper that you just have to about drown your food in black pepper to get anything out of it. So basically what we're asking our patients in the clinic to do, and what we ask you to do, is to supplement enough to replace the deficiency, and then just to keep that going with about 200 micrograms a day. You don't have to go nuts with it.
Well, what about selenium? Selenium's another important nutrient that we hear a lot about. What does it do?
Well, basically, selenium is involved in the immune system, and again, it's involved in the production of those natural free radical scavengers that we were talking about earlier. We use selenium as a kind of cofactor to build our own free radical scavengers. It works with vitamin E to produce a substance called glutathione. A deficiency of selenium, though, has been connected with an elevation of cholesterol, and I'm not exactly sure that anybody has clearly elucidated what that connection is. But it's pretty clear that there is some sort of connection.
Well, what are our best food sources of selenium?
Well, muscle meats and seafood. Of course, you're going to get those on the Protein Power Plan, unless you're a vegetarian. And if you are a vegetarian, you're going to need to supplement it. And I would supplement it at a rate of 100 or maybe 200 micrograms a day, again, as a chelate.
And while we're on the subject of vegetarians, let's look at a couple of other nutrients, taurine and carnitine, that vegetarians in particular need. Now, both of these are amino acids. They're not minerals. They're both amino acids, and they both occur in high concentrations in animal meat. Now, carnitine's crucial to moving fats into the mitochondria, which are little kind of furnaces within the cells that actually burn the fat for energy. And the fat's got to get into the mitochondria, and it's shuttled in there by the amino acid carnitine. And as I said, carnitine comes from meat. So if you don't eat meat, if you don't get meat in your diet, you need to supplement with carnitine, which you can find at any health food store. Now, the body can make taurine. That's another amino acid. It can make taurine from other amino acids if it has enough vitamin B6. But again, in vegetarians, that could be a problem. So we encourage all of our vegetarian patients to supplement with carnitine and taurine.
And with B vitamins, because the best source of B vitamins, again, are going to be meat products. So if you subscribe to a vegetarian lifestyle, both of these conditionally essential amino acids become essential for you. And so you must supplement them with capsules.
That's right. Now let's talk just a little bit about some of the electrolytes that we have in our diet. One in particular, potassium. Potassium has to be in the blood at a certain level or the electrical conductivity of the cells doesn't work properly. And what happens with potassium is that when we lower our insulin levels as we do in the Protein Power Plan and their kidney releases all this fluid that we've been retaining, the fluid also carries potassium along with it. And so we really need to replace that potassium on a Protein Power kind of plan, or people can get the symptoms of low potassium, which is called hypokalemia. And it's generally muscle cramps, some muscle pain, and some muscle fatigue, but it often comes on very quickly.
Well, where can you get the potassium?
Again, you can get the potassium in a couple of places. You can get the potassium from the foods you eat, but unfortunately, foods that have a lot of potassium, and the two that come to mind most readily are bananas and orange juice, contain a lot of carbohydrates also. So eating lots of those foods is self-defeating from an insulin-lowering perspective. So really, the best place to get potassium is in a supplemental form at the start of the program and to use it to replace that that's lost. As the program goes on and your blood fluid is stabilized, you don't have to worry about it as much. But right at the start of the program, we recommend that everyone take a potassium supplement.
And you can get those at a health food store. Potassium gluconate or other similar potassium products. In fact, I've seen one that is a potassium and magnesium aspartate. That would be a good one. Those potassium products over the counter have about 99 milligrams of potassium in them. So at that level, you need probably to take about 4 of those a day to be sure you get enough at the beginning of the program. Now, you can take higher levels of potassium in prescription strength from your physician, but everybody's not going to be able to do that. So our recommendation is that you go to the health food store and you get a potassium replacement there.
Now, we found in our clinical practice that 95%, probably 98% of the problems that people have on this program come because they don't take their potassium. And this whole idea of losing potassium shows you how really potent this program is, because it can bring about this rapid loss of potassium in just a few days when people start it, because they drop their insulin levels very, very quickly. And when their insulin levels fall, they have a diuresis. They get rid of the excess fluid they've retained, and it carries this potassium along with it. So they absolutely need to supplement with potassium. Now, as long as you've got normal kidney function, and you should know if you don't, as long as you've got normal kidney function, it's not going to hurt you to take some extra potassium at the start of this program. So remember, again, 95% of the problems we have with our own patients on this program come because they don't take potassium.
It's cheap insurance. You need to take your potassium.
So a complete vitamin and mineral supplement can help to ensure that you get all the important micronutrients to optimize your health on this program, even though you're probably going to get most of them in your food. And it's critically, critically important that you take potassium along with it. Multivitamins and the minerals act more as an insurance policy. And as Dr. Jeffrey Blumberg put it, and this is a quote, vitamins are like seat belts. Wearing a seat belt doesn't give you license to drive recklessly. It just protects you in case of an accident.